The reality of global warming began making front page headlines nearly 30 years ago. In 1995, a secret memo commissioned from a scientist at Mobil Oil and distributed to many of the world's largest fossil fuel companies warned that the reality of human-caused warming cannot be denied.
Yeah, a rather large dossier that was released and lots of facts in there. As we mentioned, spreading climate disinformation is what the intention, one of the main intentions of this dossier was. Funding a supposedly independent scientist, again, independent in quotes, which is what ExxonMobil did. Another thing that they did, owning scientists who are warning about the reality of global warming in their terms and in their way of presentation, laying out a strategy to fabricate uncertainty about climate change, and that's really important, this uncertainty part. And again, repositioning global warming as theory, not as fact, are some of the revelations of this dossier. And again, we are emphasizing how fabricating uncertainty about climate science is what their goal was. Now, what is actually the main purpose? What is their motto? The motto is, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Pretty stark, right? I'm sure you'll agree. Well, this practice of lying and concealment continues to this day. For example, in the year 2019, it was reported that some of these companies, which are concealing their climate-related activities, they've been accused of that in terms of the environmental impact that these companies actually have. In terms of the number of companies, it was roughly about 700 of them. So it's quite a lot, like Amazon, Tesco, ExxonMobil. Here we go again with ExxonMobil, and of course Facebook being some of those included in some of those companies. So 700 companies. Obviously, oversight is the key question here. But they were accused of things that were considered concealments, such as water shortages and deforestation, which is a big deal when it comes to climate change. Now, joining us for this segment is Juan Pablo Osornio. He is the global climate political leader at Greenpeace. And based on the Greenpeace website, he is the international head of delegation to the COP, which once he said politics is polluted. Also, Bill Moyer, climate change activist, rejoins us. All right, let me first turn to you, if I may, Juan Pablo. The key question here is companies like ExxonMobil knew about climate change 40 years ago or so. Old companies understood the science before it became public, and they spent millions to promote misinformation like ExxonMobil. And then 700 large companies later on worldwide failing to disclose their environmental impact. Companies like ExxonMobil again, BP and Chevron. If so, why are they allowed to operate and continue to emit CO2?
Well, first and foremost, because it's not illegal. It's not illegal to stop emitting CO2. And I would put this squarely on governments that are not actually putting in place the regulations that are going to avoid a climate emergency. Building on the IPCC report, one of the things that is very clear as a message, even though they might not say it like that, is that we need dramatic, immediate, and constant greenhouse gas emission reductions. That means no new fossil fuel capacity being built, no new fossil fuel infrastructure anywhere in the world, and looking to phase out all fossil fuel infrastructure by the mid of the century. That is, in 30 years, we shouldn't be using any more fossil fuels.
All right, Bill Moyers, let me bring you in here. That was 50 years ago, what was revealed, and then just a couple of years back, again, Fortune 500 companies like ExxonMobil, Facebook, and Amazon concealing their company's efforts on climate change. Is this about how they can get away with it? Because that's what it appears like.
Well, I think they're allowed to operate because it captured the mechanisms of power, and that's not a new story. So, of course, you know, it angers me deeply. I lead a group called Backbone Campaign, and we've been in many anti-fossil fuel company battles, from trying to stop coal exports in the Pacific Northwest, of the United States, and some accountability. I don't believe that we're there yet. I don't think we have the social movement power to enforce that, but I think that we're moving in a direction of truth and reconciliation, of removing these, of dissolving the rights that are defending these profiteers who are benefiting in the short term.
Okay, Bill Moyer, the climate activist. Now, one thing that's missing are the numbers. The numbers behind, for example, how much money is being lost due to climate change and due to CO2 emissions, in which the next report takes a close look at that. Climate change is not only a systemic risk that must be addressed now, it is also an economic risk. It could wipe off up to 18% of GDP of the worldwide economy by 2050 if global temperatures rise by 3.2 degrees Celsius. In other words, the world economy could be 10% smaller if the 2050 net zero emissions and Paris Agreement targets on climate change are not met. Under the current trajectory, global GDP could be 11 to 14% less by mid-century than in a world without climate change. The UN Environment Program estimates that the global cost of adapting to these climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050. When all is said, climate change could cut the world economy by $23 trillion by the year 2050. Just shows how severe an economic impact global warming has. There is a cost of adapting to rising sea levels. This is one of the reasons for the relocation of whole towns. Shrinking productivity of harvests is another factor. That leads to prices of basic foodstuff to rise. Extreme weather will cause widespread poverty. One of the consequences of high temperatures will be the spread of diseases. Another consequence, fresh water will be in short supply. Did you ever really think about how you spend your money and what things you spend your money on, and how you are through that in one way or another contributing to climate change as a result?
Death is upon us. The death of glaciers and ice sheets plummeting into the sea, the death of great swaths of forests. It's clear to me what's driving this descent into climate chaos: capitalism. Since its inception in the urban landscapes of England, industrial capitalism has been a juggernaut of waste, driving plunder and reckless production of needless commodities.
Okay, so that was capitalism side of things. Pretty scary, but true. Then comes what's called a zero-waste lifestyle.
This is all of my trash from the past 5 years.
Pretty incredible, isn't it? I mean, obviously very hard to do, but imagine if people actually did just even a quarter of that. Well, one major source of destruction from capitalism, coming from factories of conglomerates, is water. Clothing and fossil fuel firms are the worst offenders when it comes to polluting and wasting water, which came out through a study from CDP, a data analysis nonprofit, which said along with the clothing and fossil fuel sectors, cotton and livestock farming were also culprits.
Companies in the financial sector themselves, companies in the fossil fuel, the apparel and the food sectors represent the greatest impact on freshwater resources worldwide. It's not necessarily new information for many of us that have been working in this sector for some time, but for financial institutions themselves, who, as I said earlier, are not necessarily that well informed on the issues, this is going to provide a breakthrough moment for them to be able to figure out who or which companies in their portfolios offer the greatest chance to deliver that outcome that we're looking for.
Global fast fashion brands are helping drive pollution that has dyed African rivers blue or turned their waters to alkaline. Many firms, including Nike, Lululemon, Chevron, and Royal Dutch Shell, declined to make their data available for this study. For example, companies control or influence around 70% of the world's usable water, either through the direct operations or through their supply chains. Well, rejoining us is Juan Pablo Osornio, global climate political leader from Greenpeace, and also Bill Moyer, who's a climate change activist. All right, Juan, let me first ask you, according to various reports, global warming is caused by human activity and is rooted in a social and economic system that is based in capitalism. Materialistic tendencies which are taught at an early age, which, as a consequence, drives factory production, hence contributing to climate change. How do you think that can be controlled, if it can?
I think it needs to be controlled for those that are responsible for our well-being. And for me, it's basic that the government is the one ultimately responsible for the well-being of their citizens, for their physical safety, for peace, for health. And they know things that the general public wouldn't know. In other words, what needs to happen is that states need to come in, and there needs to be an agreement or a law where you're not allowed to trade or to profit from things that are needed for the safety and the well-being of your citizens.
All right, Bill, what do you think? Is there any hope when it comes to consumerism and, of course, capitalism as a whole and its impact on climate change?
Well, I think we began to talk about this. The problem is that policies and politics follow culture. We have to find ways to reconnect to the places that we live. We need to, like in where I live, salmon are an important species. They're important economically, but they're important as as a central species for the indigenous cultures of this place. Salmon are also an amazing example of the abundance of nature when humans get out of the way. We need to get out of the way.
All right. I'd like to thank both of our guests. That was Bill Moyer there, climate change activist, and also Juan Pablo Sornillo, the climate political leader at Greenpeace, both of them with great contributions there. Right now it's time to see how climate change could actually hit the financial system and the very financial institutions that are behind the banks and behind the Fortune 500 companies, and they should think twice for giving them more credit or lending them more money. I wish there was a solution to offer you in my final thoughts as to how we can reduce climate change to zero. But right there, that is the wrong approach. Climate change cannot be reduced to zero. But something can be done to reduce the Earth's warming. For starters, green energy transformation needs to be fully executed, like solar energy. Green energy in the form of electric cars is also another idea. Obviously, that's being currently executed. But consumerism is part of that equation, meaning the capitalistic society. That remains under doubt as to whether that can be changed. How can anyone convince these multinationals to not produce as much and for us not to buy as much? I mean, they have shareholders that they have to respond to, and ultimately they need the sales. Who can change that when in Western countries people are brought up to follow and buy and purchase? The pattern, obviously, is to buy, to work, and to keep buying, which is what societies are built on. That is the challenge. Thanks for joining us in this edition of Economic Divide. It's a pleasure having you on board this program. Any questions or comments, do send them to us. From Mikhail Vitali, it's goodbye. Until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Iran is a beautiful country with different ethnicities, languages, and cultures. Along with the diversity of ethnicities, people with different religions have been coexisting peacefully in this land. This coexistence has actually doubled the beauty of Iran. I am now in the beautiful city of Tabriz, beside the Saint Mary Church. Today I'm going to visit one of the most beautiful churches of Iran, Sohreghe Church, in a village with the same name. Sohreghe or Sahrol village is located 13 kilometers from Tabriz Marand Road. On one of the hills of this village, there is an old church. The construction of Sohreghe Church ended in 1840. Sohreghe Church has been built on the remains of a church belonging to 5th and 6th AD. Archaism of the building has been made by Russian architects and Azerbaijani masters. The covering of the church's ceiling consists of three different domes: a small dome on the apse, a big conical dome on the central hall, and a dome for the bell tower. This building is brick-made, and the brickwork of the dome is one of the most important architectural aspects of the Qajari era. Now, I have left the Sohreghe village and I'm setting off to the Sohreghe church. There are green, beautiful meadows with hills full of flowers around as far as the eye could see. And after climbing this small hill, there is a big hill where the church is located. My God, it's incredible. One of the most beautiful sceneries I've ever seen in whole of my life. Sohreghe Church is shining like a red gem in the middle of the green hills. Oh, I must take photos from this dazzling scenery. Though, even
The most and best photos can't exactly describe the beauty and grandeur of this region. Inside the Sohrege Church. This church consists of three parts: the entrance, the central hall, and the apse. Here is the central hall of the church, which is built in a rectangular shape. The ceiling of the building is dome-like. And here, there is a brick-made balcony which has two staircases. These staircases end in the bell tower. I wish I could go up the stairs, but actually I'm really tired to do so. You know, I have walked a long way to get here. Sohrege Church was severely damaged after the 1936 earthquake, and what is left from that era is one of the examples of the rich architecture of Azerbaijan. Oh, well, there are some benches outside the church, which I'm going to take a rest on one of them and watch the stunning building of Sohrege Church with the hills around.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Round the world with reporters.
A high-level Lebanese ministerial and security delegation has arrived in Damascus. Deputy Prime Minister of the Lebanese caretaker government, Zain Akkar, who holds several other positions, headed the delegation, which included the ministers of energy and finance, as well as head of the General Directorate of General Security. They were welcomed by Syria's foreign minister at the Jdeidet Yabus crossing. The delegation held talks with several Syrian officials at once at the foreign ministry, namely the Syrian ministers of foreign affairs, finance, and oil. Talks focused on economic cooperation and Lebanon's need of Syria's help in transferring gas for generating electricity.
The two sides discussed the difficult circumstances they are living in, especially the electricity and gas sectors. The Lebanese side asked Syria to help Lebanon in transferring Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through Syrian territories. The Syrian side welcomed our request and expressed Syria's readiness to assist.
Both sides agreed to follow up the technical aspects and details of implementation through a joint technical team. Observers believe such a visit was only possible due to the U.S. backing of a plan that ensures Lebanon obtains gas.
I think Lebanon got a green light from the U.S. for such a visit. The Syrian government conveyed a message to the Lebanese side that it has accepted their request. I think the matter now is in the hands of Lebanon to get a regional and international approval for Syria's participation in pumping gas to Lebanon as there are U.S. and EU economic sanctions on Syria.
Lebanon is seeking to revive a 2009 deal which stipulated that Egypt transfers millions of cubic meters of gas annually to Syria through Jordan, while Syria pumps the same amount to Lebanon. This is Lebanese officials' most significant visit to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. Lebanon, which remained relatively neutral towards Syria for so long, seems to have no other option now in light of its economic slowdown but to fully reactivate its cooperation and relations with Syria in hopes of some economic relief. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Streets remain deserted and business establishments closed in all major towns and the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir for the second day after the death of the region's veteran separatist leader, Saeed Ali Gilani. Indian forces continued a strong presence to prevent anti-government protests and enforce a strict lockdown. The authorities had also imposed near-total communication blockade across Kashmir as a precautionary measure to maintain law and order. On Friday, additional deployments were made to prevent people from holding anti-government protests after the Friday prayers.
Gilani, the most powerful separatist leader in Kashmir who spent many years in different jails, died on Wednesday evening at his Srinagar residence, where he had remained incarcerated for the past decade.
As the news of his death spread far and wide, authorities swung into action and sealed the roads leading to Gilani's Haidarpura residence. Security was beefed up across the region, barricades erected, and key roads sealed, calling and internet services were shut. According to his family members, the former lawmaker, who after quitting electoral politics in late 1980s had for years spearheaded the separatist movement in Kashmir, had desired to be buried in Srinagar's historic martyrs' graveyard. But the family members alleged that police forcibly took away his body and in a quiet funeral, buried him in a graveyard near his residence.
He passed away late evening. We live in his neighborhood. We were neither allowed to visit his residence to pay him last respect, not allowed to participate in his funeral sitting COVID. This is very unfortunate. It will hurt us forever. We wanted to participate in the funeral procession of our leader, but we were not allowed by forces. He was hurriedly buried, and no one was allowed to say him the final goodbye. At least we should have been allowed to offer funeral prayers.
Known for his pro-Pakistan stance, Gilani led several anti-India protests and marches. He became a household name during 2008 and 2010 public uprising in Kashmir. A staunch advocate of Kashmir's right to self-determination, Gilani had stepped down as Hurriyat Conference chairman after he suffered with ailing health. He was conferred Pakistan's highest civilian honor in 2020. His death has been widely condoled, with Pakistan's Premier Imran Khan describing him as, quote, Mujahid-e-Kashmir. Meanwhile, police spokesman has said that there has been no incident of violence or protest in Kashmir after Gilani's death. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts. Sidri Safib, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A new major victory has been achieved by the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's oil-rich province of Marib. Yemen's armed forces have recaptured the strategic Rahba district and the southern Marib, meaning that all supply routes linking Al-Bayda and Marib will be cut off from the Saudi-backed forces.
Cutting off the supplies in Al-Rahba would weaken the enemy forces. There is also synchronization in the movement of our forces in the rest of the northern and southern fronts towards the city of Marib, and this constitutes a siege on the city from all sides. All supplies have been cut off from the Saudi-led forces, and they can no longer carry out any military action. Light weapons will be more effective, and the army is now able to advance more towards Harib and Al-Juba.
The Yemeni army has also managed to take control of other military sites overlooking the city of Marib from the western and northern sides, which would help the armed forces continue advancing towards the Harib and Al-Juba areas.
The Yemeni army managed to liberate the entire district of Al-Rahba and cut off the supply routes from Al-Bayda. With that, the liberation of Al-Juba and Habri area became easier for the Yemeni army. there is an insistence by the Yemeni army to liberate the city of Ma'arib, especially after the Saudi-led coalition's rejection of Ansar Allah's recent initiative to stop military operations there.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations aimed at liberating the strategic Ma'arib province from the Saudi-backed forces, including terrorist groups. Ma'arib has strategic importance as an oil-rich province. It is the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Yemenis believe that their army will eventually liberate Ma'arib from all foreign powers, including the Saudi-backed forces. They say now Riyadh has to bear the consequences of its disregard for Ansarullah's recent initiative to end the ongoing crisis in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washari, Sana'a.
Overnight security clampdown and communications blackout occurred in Indian-administered Kashmir after the region's iconic leader, Syed Ali Shah Gilani, died. The mosques in the region announced the demise. However, Gilani's followers were not able to participate in his funeral prayers.
Every home in Kashmir is mourning this loss. Authorities do not allow anyone to move out of homes. They should not have done this. It was our right to participate in his funeral prayers. After all, India claims to be a democracy. Can't we even mourn?
Officials say people's participation could have resulted in massive law and order problems.
Restrictions were imposed to keep law and order in place. No untoward incident occurred anywhere during the last 24 hours, and the situation has been peaceful.
Kashmir has witnessed a record number of internet blackouts in the world and is the world's largest militarized zone. Analysts say people of Kashmir have been forced into this silence since India stripped Kashmir of its autonomous status in August 2019.
The silence which was imposed upon the people is a human rights violation. They could not go to attend the funeral of their one of the veteran tallest leaders of Jammu and Kashmir, who has all along his life said and advocated about the right to self-determination.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned the Indian government's denial of right to choose burial rituals inside of the Syed Ali Shah Gilani. Observers say people of Kashmir have been forced into a controlled kind of a life where every rule is not set by their choice, but by the force of the governing authorities.
Syed Ali Gilani was one of the tallest leaders of the resistance movement of Jammu and Kashmir and was advocating for right to self-determination. He deserved a respectful funeral, but the government did not allow the funeral to happen other than his family members. International covenants and international law says that every person who dies is to be handed over to his family for a choicest burial and a choicest funeral.
People of Kashmir say since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party took a unanimous decision on Kashmir's special status in August 2019, a lot has changed without their consent. They say the silence of international community on the plight of Kashmiri people has added to their miseries, and with each passing day, living in the controlled land is getting difficult for them. And sooner or later, Kashmiri people are going to be the world's new asylum seekers. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
A house was recently bombed by a U.S. drone strike. Shrapnels have even damaged the door of the house. 10 members of a single family, including 6 children, lost their lives in the recent U.S. drone strike. As the relatives of the victims say, the owner of the house, which was targeted by the attack, was an engineer with no ties to any terrorist group. Imal Ahmadi is the brother of the owner of the house. He explains how the U.S. airstrike claimed the lives of his beloved ones in a moment.
I had left the house almost 10 minutes before that U.S. brutal attack. I quickly got back after I received a call from a relative. I saw the dead bodies of my brother, his sons and daughters all over the yard.
Blaming the U.S. for launching blind attacks on civilian areas, Emal is also angry on international journalists and the United Nations for what he says turning a blind eye on their misery.
A number of local and international journalists have so far interviewed us, but no one, including the United Nations, has heard our voice. Everybody follows his or her own agenda with paying no attention to our demand. We want justice, and the UN is responsible.
It was August 30 when the US Air Strike hit this vehicle inside a house located in northeastern Kabul. Later, Pentagon said that they have successfully eliminated a vehicle packed with explosives in the city of Kabul. However, Taliban urgently condemned the attack, calling it an inhuman assault on civilians. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union a substantial migrant deal. Turkish Foreign Minister said in a joint presser with Dutch Foreign Minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said his country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse, assuring that international cooperation is needed to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan.
There is an urgent need for a new deal for sure. However, this time the deal will be different than the previous one due to the changes that took place worldwide. Not only is it up to EU and Turkey, but also the United States is involved in the issue of Afghan refugees. Turkey now has closed its borders in front of refugees, not only because a deal is not reached yet, but the burden of refugees is actually affecting the AKP internally as well. People have started to feel the burden of migrants and the country and are now pressuring the government to stop receiving them.
The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
As they stood for a photograph ahead of their latest meeting on Friday, EU foreign affairs ministers appeared to be in a jovial mood. However, critics say they have little to laugh about given the West's role in the Afghan crisis. At a press conference following the meeting, it was made clear the EU is not encouraging Afghan refugees to travel to the 27-country bloc.
The own commitments of the Taliban to let people to go out if they want. It doesn't mean that we have any kind of commitment from the member states to take care of them.
That statement is likely to enrage rights groups and aid agencies. Oxfam had already published a statement accusing the EU of turning its back on Afghan refugees. European Commission data suggests 3.5 million people are currently internally displaced within the country. One in three are going hungry. 500,000 people are currently trying to leave Afghanistan, according to the Commission. EU lawmakers say it's not fair for the EU to place the responsibility of refugees on neighbouring countries like Pakistan and Iran.
Make sure that they have and they will own their migration crisis and that we stay away from that as best we can. I think that is hypocritical at best.
A coordinated strategy by the EU to the refugee crisis is urgently required, experts argue.
If the European Union was able to react, to respond to the refugee challenge collectively, the individual burden for every single country would be much lower.
The role the EU, NATO, Britain and the US played in Afghanistan has been castigated in the European Parliament.
The Americans lied to their people. The Americans spent over $2.2 trillion, and over $2 trillion of it went to private contractors.
One legislator suggests the EU misjudged the level of support that exists for the Taliban.
They obviously were appealing for many in Afghanistan because otherwise they hadn't taken over the country so quickly.
Without assistance from the international community, European Commission officials forecast medical supplies will run out in Kabul within 2 weeks, and 120 children in the country could die every single day. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
If you live in England, chances are you're already paying more for your food. And it all begins here. Every year, tens of thousands of people come to work on UK farms from Eastern Europe. This year, the workforce is already down more than 10%. The culprit, farmers and economists say, Brexit.
We, as a farmer, are hugely passionate about employing local people, and there are many roles and career opportunities for local people here, but we simply don't have the people coming forward for the jobs.
Since Brexit, the right for EU workers to just turn up in the UK is no longer. The government quota only allows 30,000 EU labourers onto UK farms now. The industry say they need twice that number.
The cause of that shortage is a mixture of incompetence and hubris, because the British government said, oh yes, we can leave the EU, and after that everything is hunky-dory, we can rely on America.
The labour shortage is not limited to British farms only. They go across the board. The hospitality sector, for example, is 180,000 short. The meat processing sector, 5,000. When there are so many vacancies in so many different sectors in an interconnected economy, that is a problem.
One problem is in the haulage industry. Plenty of work, not enough drivers. With many waiting in long queues to take their driving tests, which stopped during COVID, creating a backlog that snowballed with Brexit. Meaning the industry is now 15,000 drivers short. Some have offered a substantial pay rise for drivers to lure more people into the job. Experts say there is a problem with that.
It is far from certain that even a price rise will actually solve the solution. For a start, it's not going to bring back those EU drivers for a start. They've probably gone. So you see, the situation is bad. It doesn't look as though they can solve it at the moment, and it's going to be one of the factors of many putting up the prices very considerably in the shops.
For some industries here, COVID sent thousands of workers home. Brexit's been a big hurdle for many to come back. The one thing a post-pandemic rebound economy needs, though, is labor wherever it's from. And as long as this chronic shortage of labor exists, the average Briton will feel the pinch at the cash register. Saeed Pereza, London.
As an example of popular resistance, Palestinians held several rallies on Thursday along the separation fence. There were huge night confrontations, and Palestinians called for a complete lifting of the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip as a result of the continuous gathering by the borders that has been going on for almost 2 weeks. The Israeli regime began to submit to the Palestinian pressure as a list of Palestinian demands has been implemented.
Israel's new measures and facilities are not coming for the favor of the Palestinian side as much as they come to prevent the Palestinian outrage and try to restore peace by the border. Israel is afraid of these gatherings that represent the popular resistance resulted from the deteriorating life Gazans are living. These facilitations are never enough, and Palestinians want a complete end of the siege.
During the clashes, Palestinians burned tires and threw explosives to disturb the Israeli army. The regime soldiers fired live bullets and tear gas at protesters during the nighttime clashes.
Those are not facilitations. The new decisions are simple rights of the Palestinians that the Israeli regime has deprived us of for 50 years. Palestinians are living their worst times ever. While there is no medicine, no food, and we have to take action, all spheres of Gazans are here protesting peacefully, and these protests are ongoing until all the blockade is over.
Palestinians insist on keeping the resistance, starting from nightly confusion to incendiary balloons and clashing with the Israeli regime along the borders. The Israeli regime has not yet kept up with the demands of Palestinians, including ending the Kraplin blockade. Meanwhile, the resistance confirms that the Israeli new measures are not enough.
These Israeli facilities are not a gift from Israel. There are legal Palestinian rights, and this move shows that the Palestinian outrage forced the Israeli regime to submit to the Palestinian demands partially. Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and their lands, and the resistance will go on until a complete lifting of the siege.
Palestinians here stress that the popular resistance should be held along with the armed resistance until all Palestinian demands are completely achieved. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
In a small lab in Tehran, a big dream is unfolding. An expert team comprised of over 30 young Iranian physicists and engineers are putting the first building blocks of what would be the first Iranian-made particle accelerator. Also called synchrotron, the device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light in a large donut-shaped vacuum chamber. The process seems simple in words, but it's painstakingly complicated in practice.
At the center of this laboratory complex, a fourth-generation synchrotron is located, which accelerates electrons to nearly the speed of light by using radio frequency systems and powerful electromagnets, and finally produces exceptionally brilliant beams of light in a wide spectrum ranging from infrared and visible light to ultraviolet and hard X-rays.
First built in the 1940s, synchrotrons were originally made to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice the synchrotron's byproduct, an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
The X-ray produced in this machine is a million times brighter than the other conventional X-ray sources. And it has also unique properties such as high coherency and polarization, tunability, and ultra-short pulses, which enables the scientists to achieve high-quality imaging. Information obtained by scientists can be used to study the structure of viruses and proteins, design new drugs, precise radiography from human body, examine the structure of surfaces, build smaller and powerful computer chips, develop new materials for safer medical implants, and help with the cleanup of mining waste.
The Iranian synchrotron is for now in the R&D stage. The developer's team says the project needs $300 million to be accomplished. So far, only 1% of the budget is supplied. The team hopes by shedding light on the significance of the cutting-edge technology, it can attract the needed investment from the government.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown synchrotron would transform technologies. Experts say, for sanctions hit Iran, building such a device is more than just an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Bahrain has actually demonstrated its complicity in crimes committed by the Zionist regime against the Palestinians by appointing its first ambassador to the occupied territories. Analysts believe that it is only a matter of time for the Al Khalifa and the Zionist regime to meet their deserving end, since they cannot continue to resist the people's will. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading Joint Suicidal Pact Between Al Khalifa and Zionist Regime. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. There are some harebrained people who never learn from mistakes and continue to commit more and more blunders until their suicidal course is complete. One glaring example in this regard is the repressive Al Khalifa minority regime of Bahrain, which has tied its fate to the illegal Zionist entity called Israel and is blindly going down the drain with the occupiers of Palestine. In fact, treason is writ large on the faces of the pirates of Manama, who imprisoned the innocent Bahraini people, tortured them, killed them, expelled them, and deprived them of their birthrights. A couple of days ago, in an affront to the proud Muslim people of Bahrain, the Al Khalifa allowed the Zionist regime to open its embassy in Manama, ignoring the vociferous protest of the tens of thousands of Bahrainis who once again took to the streets to express solidarity with the oppressed Palestinian Muslims. Eitan Naa was nominated recently as the Zionist regime's first ambassador to Bahrain, the same day that Bahrain's first ambassador to the occupied territories, Khaled Yusuf Al Jalama, met with Foreign Minister Yair Lapid in the Knesset and presented him with a copy of his diplomatic credentials. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said Bahrain has actually demonstrated its complicity in crimes committed by the Zionist regime against Palestinians by appointing its first ambassador to the occupied territories. Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qasem said the appointment of an ambassador of the Bahraini regime to the Zionist entity reflects its insistence on the national sin that it committed when it signed the normalization agreement with the occupation. Qasem noted that the move represents Bahrain's clear support for Israeli regime's atrocities against the Palestinians and its full complicity in the crimes committed by Tel Aviv. Bahrainis, meanwhile, have staged a demonstration in condemnation of normalization of diplomatic ties between the tiny Persian Gulf sheikhdom and the illegal Zionist entity. People took to the streets recently to condemn the repressive Ali Khalifa regime's unnatural ties with the Israeli regime, calling it treason. The participants demanded that the Ali Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established. The protesters voiced solidarity with jailed political activists and demanded their immediate release. Analysts believe that it is only a matter of time for the Ali Khalifa and the Zionist regime to meet their deserving end, since they cannot continue to resist the people's will.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein and his followers endured agonizing pain and suffering during Ashura, November 21st, 2012. The pain and suffering which Imam Hussein and his followers endured on the day of Ashura were too agonizing, and the harm which was inflicted was very serious. The life of Hussein ibn Ali is more valuable than everything in the world. The pure and sacred lives of those followers of Imam Hussein, the lives of those youth and those members of Imam Hussein's household are not comparable to the life of other people. Their bodies were covered in blood and dirt. They made sacrifices and they laid down their lives. The households of the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali were imprisoned. Those events are very tragic and very difficult to tolerate. But what was achieved on the day of Ashura was so great and glorious that it made it easy for Imam Hussein and his followers and his household to endure the sufferings. This has been narrated by prominent figures. Imam Hussein sustained the path of the Holy Prophet, November 21st, 2012. The Islamic Ummah should never forget the event of Ashura, which is a lesson and a source of guidance for us. Definitely, Islam is alive because of the event of Ashura and the efforts of Hussein ibn Ali. And I am from Hussein. This narration means that Hussein continued the path of the Holy Prophet, and he continued to promote Islam after him. If it had not been for the event of Ashura, and if these great sacrifices had not been made in the history of Islam, this valuable experience and this practical lesson would not have been bestowed on the Islamic Ummah, and Islam would have definitely deviated from its path, as many religions before Islam did, and nothing would have remained from it. The greatness of Ashura is because of this.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا